Hey guys, this is Adrian Vandenberg, formerly of Whitesnake and these days of Vandenberg, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
To be. This is small town music. This is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote the new Vandenberg album called Sin, please welcome guitarist Adrian Vandenberg. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am good. It's actually morning for me, but it's not morning for you. Where are you located, Adrian?
Right now, I'm in France. Things could be worse. The sun is shining, and it's 6 o'clock in the evening, actually.
Very nice. So, I'm in Los Angeles, 9 a.m., and the sun is also shining, so all good things.
Yeah, all good things. I actually left 2 weeks ago. I was in Los Angeles, and as always, a lot of fun. It's I spend so much time in my Whitesnake days in Los Angeles that I still feel at home over there, even though I'm not there as often as I would like to. But hopefully that's going to change in the near future. You know, who knows?
Hopefully you guys get on the road. You do some dates all around the world. That would be great.
Yeah, we've been all over the place lately.
Okay, so the new album is Sin. It actually comes out August 25th. It's the fifth album by the band Vandenberg, and your fourth since 2020 with the album called 2020.
So yes, exactly.
Tell everyone who the current lineup of Vandenberg is.
The rhythm section is the same as on the 2020 album. Koen Herfst on drums and Randy van der Elven on bass, and I'm sure these names sounds pretty exotic to American people. And then there's the Scandinavian vocalist Mats Levén, not also very exotic to Americans. And well, my name is relatively pronounceable since I started touring the States in '83 for the first time.
Let me ask you about Mats. To my ears on this new album, he has a very David-like tone to his voice at times.
He does, you know, he's got a similar timbre, which is, you know, which is always quite crucial, of course, to, like, for instance, one of the examples that I regularly bring up, a lot of people don't realize how Steve Perry from Journey, formerly of Journey, how much he's been influenced by Sam Cooke from the 50s and the 60s, because they have a slightly different voice. And then Rod Stewart, same thing. Rod Stewart is very influenced by Sam Cooke, but his voice is so different that you don't even hear it. But of course, Mats has always been has also been influenced by singers like Coverdale, but since he has a very similar timbre, he's got this strong, dark brown, low end rumble in the voice as well. It's even more resembling David's way of singing. But next to that, Coverdale is definitely one of his influences. Mutz grew up when Mutz was in early 20s or late teens, when he was growing up in Scandinavia and listening to rock music. Of course, you know, guys like Coverdale and like guys like Ian Gillan and Robert Plant, all those guys, and Ronnie Dio, when you're a late teenager, they start to influence you. And he, just like me, he wears his influences proudly on his sleeve. And it fits really well with the kind of music that I've been writing.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to be influenced by all those singers that you just mentioned when you're in your teens and you're coming up.
Yeah.
trying to form your own vocal style. But I think he sounds so terrific on this new album. It's fantastic.
He does. I'm really excited about it. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. This album cover is very reminiscent of the second album, Heading for the Storm, which features the three sharks. Did you do the artwork for the Sin album cover?
Yes, I am. The early Vandenberg albums, the second and third one, were oil paintings, and I thought it would be a good thing to pick up that red thread since I picked up the name again. And if you remember, maybe, or some of the listeners may remember too, that the second Vandenberg album, which was 1984, I think, or 83 actually, there were the three sharks flying over a highway in the middle of a desert.
Right.
I thought it would be kind of cool to let them fly into New York City as some kind of an arrival. And that's also connected to the album title and the song title, Sin, because for me, if you think about the biblical connection, it was about, when the sin, the original sin started, it was the snake and the apple. And of course, you know, New York is named the apple, plus yep. It is a serious city, a city of sin, of course. So I thought it was a great connection to let those fly, those sharks fly into New York City and kind of make it a whole theme. And the people who come to our show will also hear that the intro tape I made for the shows is also connected, but I'm not disclosing anything about that. You just have to come.
So you've done the album artwork for the second album, Heading for a Storm, the third album, Alibi, and for the recent album, Sin. So yes. I want to ask you, you're very talented in music and art. Which came first?
They came simultaneously. When I was a kid, I was always drawing and painting and stuff. And a little bit later on, actually, my mom told me that when I was about 5 or 6, I was running around the house with a cigar box on my dad with elastic bands over it, and went down, 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 down all day until it drove her crazy. So at some point, decided, well, maybe make it more serious and give him a guitar. So that's what happened. And then I always thought, you know, it was a very normal thing to do and was kind of assuming that everybody would do that until I found out that that my friends that I played soccer with and hung out with, they didn't do any of that. And I thought, wow, why not? So I remember asking one or two of them, why don't you guys do that? And they went, well, we can't. I said, why not? Well, we don't do that, you know. So it kind of surprised me. I didn't understand why they didn't do that, because to me it came so naturally. And it's been off and on in balance throughout my life. When I was about 18, my dad gave up on me being a scientist like he was. And he decided, well, you know, he's always been doing this guitar thing and piano and painting, so maybe it's a good idea to have him take a proper education in one or the other. And he told me, you know, you can go either to the Conservatory of Music or go to the University of Arts. And I thought, well, I'm probably going to end up as a teacher, so I might as well go to the University of Arts, because I can't picture myself having the patience of listening to guys go down, 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 you know. I don't even have the patience for myself, let alone for other people. So I decided I'll go to the arts direction. And I studied for 5 years, and I actually taught art for about a year and a half at a high school until I got fed up with it, because it was, first of all, the board of parents didn't like me dating the girls in my classroom, which still surprises me to this day. Not, but it was so regular. You had to get up, you know, a certain time in the morning. You had to be at the school at 8:15 with like a little lunchbox. And then I had to listen to all that blabbering of all those boring teachers that you were in a coffee room with. I thought, man, I'm not going to deal with it. And so I decided to work as a graphic artist, and I worked for a couple of advertising agencies and publishing companies. With the money I made, I sold my paintings already at the time. And with the money I made, I financed the first demo for the early Zandenberg albums, actually.
That's amazing. You had all these mini careers before you hit on music.
Yeah, because I never had the illusion that with the kind of music that I love to play, which is hard rock, that I would ever be able to make a living in Holland, because I didn't have any illusions that I was going to be able to do that outside of Holland. And I always had a rock band ever since I was 15 or something. But I mean, in Holland, you know, there only have been not even a handful of bands that kind of did well outside of Holland. And my kind of rock is never been on the radio. And even Here I Go Again, you know, the number one hit, we have the Whitesnake.
Yeah.
In Holland, I think it was barely made it to top 10, and then it disappeared. And Holland has always been a country where that kind of rock is not, you know, played on the radio. And there is a big crowd for it, you know, because whenever AC/DC plays or Van Halen used to play or whatever, they sell out in a minute. But, you know, media kind of ignore it.
That's wild. That's very strange. But you brought up Van Halen, so I want to ask you this. The name Vandenberg, was that always going to be the name of your band, you know, like Van Halen? Or were there other band names tossed around?
Yeah, there were. And then at some point, the A&R manager from my record company at the time, Warner Brothers, he said, why don't you call it Vandenberg? It's your band. It sounds good. And it got a certain power to it. And initially, I thought, oh, I'm not sure whether I want, you know, the band name to be my name, because I already wrote the songs, I wrote the lyrics, I did all the interviews, I did all that stuff. And I thought, if it's going to be my name as well, you know, it's almost like a solo career. And I really wanted to have like a band vibe, which I still do, because all the bands that I'm still fan of and that I've always been a fan of always had this band vibe, and weren't like a rotating, like a revolving door in a warehouse where every other album has got a different lineup. You know, you never get to really identify with a band. I always like it when you know, there's a pretty solid lineup. So I wasn't too enthusiastic in the beginning, but at some point I thought, well, okay, you know, I don't have a better alternative, basically.
I want to let people know, before we get too far into some other things, where they can find Vandenberg. Your website's vandenbergband.com, Twitter and Instagram at Vandenberg Band. I also want people to know that the album comes out again, August 25th, CD, digital, and you can get it on limited edition green vinyl. Very cool that vinyl's back. Is this the first Vandenberg album to be released on vinyl in quite a while, I would assume?
Well, actually, the 2020 album was also on vinyl.
It was? Okay.
And the goofy thing, of course, is that in the early Vandenberg albums, there was just vinyl in those days. It was normal. And when it kind of, well, there were cassettes, of course, you know, especially in the States, people had 8-tracks and stuff. And I still have some of the cassettes. And I read an article a while ago that thanks to that successful Netflix series Stranger Things, which of course played in the 80s, that a lot of kids went, oh, what is that cool little thing, you know, the tape and stuff. So apparently there's quite a run on the cassettes again, which is that actually is quite confrontational with your age, basically, to think, well, I knew those things, you know. It's pretty funny.
I don't even know who has a device to play a cassette on anymore. It would be difficult to find.
Yeah, I still kept mine, actually. And I used to make all my demos on cassettes. I had a 4-track cassette player, and then I kind of copied them on a regular stereo cassette. So I still wanted to be able to play them, because every once in a while I listen back to some old ideas. For the hell of it, and then you get plays back in the 80s. I thought that was pretty funny. But and also I found a while ago a Walkman, like a solid chrome Walkman, that I've never used, because it was a present from my management in the Whitesnake days. I was carrying this huge box of cassettes with me, like everybody else, you know. And so that's one of the few advantages of Spotify. You don't have to drag all this stuff around anymore.
That's true. That's very true. The first single that was released from Sin is House on Fire. Terrific song. Did you write all the songs on Sin by yourself?
For the first time since working with David Coverdale, I collaborated with Mats, the singer, because he had good lyrical ideas, and we both worked on the arrangements and stuff. What usually happens is I come up with the structure of the song with the riff and all that stuff, and pretty much always with the first line or first couple of lines of the chorus. And then we play around with it. And then, like, for instance, the title trick was went a little differently. I had all the instrumental stuff. And I remember taking a walk in France, where I am right now again. And during this walk, within 3 minutes, the lyric and the melody for the intro and the chorus and the pre-chorus kind of got picked up by my mental antenna. So I built it into my iPhone, which I usually do in order not to, lose the idea. And I sent it to Mats, and I said, you know, I got the intro and chorus and pre-chorus. Come up with some ideas for the verses. And Mats came up with the verses and so the theme was already there, but with the other songs, I usually come up with the first or first two chorus lines, including usually the title, and that gives Mats some kind of a starting point. And then he usually takes it into a bit of a darker direction than I would normally do, like House on Fire. I had the first line, let's set this house on fire, you know, like going to a party, because it has a bit of a party vibe.
Sure.
And he changed it a little bit into, I'm going to set your house on fire. And it's about this twisted guy who's frustrated about the whole world and wants to set the whole place on fire. So it was something different than I originally thought. So that's really cool, because so we work surprisingly well together, which is a bonus, you know, because you never know. It's when you work creatively, you want to be on the same page, which I was with Cody all the time too. And it works out really well with Mats. He's got great ideas, and we put together the arrangements together and stuff. So yeah, it's going great, actually.
Excellent. Good to hear. I'm glad you have a partner to collaborate with again. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about songwriting, because I was listening to the 1997 Starkers in Tokyo Whitesnake album. It's just you and David, and you're on acoustic guitar. Is that the instrument of choice when you're writing songs, an acoustic?
No, not really. It was actually that album was not meant as an album. It was a radio show in Tokyo, and there were about maybe 60, 80 people or something present, and they were winners of a contest. So it was a live broadcast on radio. Yep. And afterwards we thought, well, wait a minute, this is going to be bootlegged like crazy, of course, because it's on the radio. So it would be a good idea, because we were happy with the performance, to quickly release it as an album, which was done. So it became a very popular album, and we did a promotional tour for that album to a couple of European countries. And that's how we played it, you know. My instrument of choice is usually an electric guitar or a piano, and sometimes an acoustic. But when I start on an acoustic, then I come up with stuff like Sailing Ships, like the Whitesnake song.
The wind was with you when you left on the morning tide. You set your sails for an island in the sun. But on the horizon, there are dark clouds up ahead. And the storm has just begun. So take me with you, take me far away. Lead me to the distant shore. And sail your ship across the water. Spread your wings across the sky. And take the time to see you're the one.
And I originally wrote those parts for my mom, because she always used to tell me, "Adrian, is there going to be an acoustic song on the album? Because the rest is so loud." So I said, "Yeah, Mom, sure." So I wrote this little bit for her, not meaning for it to be on an album. But then David heard it and he said, "Well, do you mind if I make a lyric on it?" I said, "No, go ahead, you know." So he did, and they turned into Sailing Ships. And then I remember putting that loud bit at the end when it suddenly breaks into the big orchestral part, recording it on my cassette recorder at the time, the demo, and it became, it became the record.
Excellent. One of my favorites on the Starkers album is The Deeper the Love, just a fantastic version of that song. You both sound fantastic. Just love it so much.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
When I look back on everything I've done, I know you must have cried a river of tears. And you were there, but I was feeling low, to walk me through my darkest fears. So when the sun goes down and those nights are growing colder, I will be there, looking over your shoulder. And the deeper the love, the stronger the emotion. And the stronger the love.
When you and David would write songs in Whitesnake, I mean, this was after you had written three albums on your own, lyrics and music. Were you in charge of music only and David did the lyrics, or did you guys both do a little of each?
Yeah, we both did a little of each. David usually writes the lyrics, which you can easily recognize by his, the themes that he uses is pretty much always love. You know, I think Whitesnake has got more songs with the world love in it than any other band in the world. I think he did a great job with with Sailing Ships and with Judgment Day.
From the darkness comes a smile that reaches out for many miles, touching everyone. No more shadows of the past, your spirit free to fly at last, shining in the sun.
I think those are probably definitely Ben Ships, who I think is one of his better lyrics, I think, because it wasn't the typical Coverdale I Love You Baby type of stuff. He can be really good with his stuff. And the thing with David is, what's always really interesting, is David is one of those few singers. Of course, he's got this amazing voice, and it sounds like, even live or on radio or whatever, it sounds like his voice is already fully produced, you know, in the studio. It's got everything and the resonance and the highs and the low and everything. So David is one of the few singers. He can sing like a kiddie song and make it sound credible as a Led Zeppelin song or as a White Snake song or something, you know. He's got this talent of making everything sounds really great vocally, no matter what he sings. And when we used to hang out together in his in the evening when we were done writing, we used to watch movies and stuff in his home theater. And sometimes we would play some old blues stuff, and he would be singing with it, you know, like soul stuff or blues stuff, and that's where he came from.
Yeah,
he's been doing that ever since he was 16 or something. And but a lot of people don't know, but once you hear it, you really realize it, how deeply his roots are in the blues. And that separated him and still separates him from a lot of rock singers, because a lot of rock singers are usually more the operatic type of singers, you know, like, you know, the higher screaming with the big vibrato and stuff. And David is more a blues singer, you know, and that's what definitely was, I think, one of the strong points when we broke with Whitesnake in 1987. It was something that especially the American people didn't really hear that often, because, you know, you had the band like Rat and Van Halen, and, well, although David Roth was pretty blues-based as well, but most of the L.A. bands were just a very different kind of singer, you know, like Vince Neil and Stephen Pearcy. They were definitely different. And then suddenly David comes on the scene with this big, huge, soulful voice, and people went, what is going on over here, you know? We could really tell every night when we started the show. And he started with his big squeals, and he used to talk. When he does the announcement of the songs, he sounds, you know, like with his big, low voice, and he doesn't go, he cries, and then, like a lot of people do.
Yeah.
There was another point that people really look, oh, this is different.
Yeah, the self-titled Whitesnake album is kind of amazing in 1987, because Whitesnake had been around for so long at that point, and many of us in the States, we didn't know about Whitesnake, but then this thing called MTV was around.
Yeah, right.
All of a sudden, here we go. Who are these guys?
Yeah.
Started shaking and I can't take no more.
And you know, the album's great and the songs are great. How important was Tawny Katane in helping break the band just as a presence in those videos?
Well, from what I hear and read, a lot of people think she was quite important in it, and she probably was, because she was the videos done by Marty Kalman, the video director, were really with a finger on the heartbeat of those days. You know, it was very polished and very cinematographic. What's the word? I think something like that. I'm a Dutch guy. I don't know, but then it just the chemistry between her and the camera and the way how Marty Conner kind of segued it into the song at the right moments and stuff. And I think it was quite important. You know, it's pretty much every band in those days had like a pretty girl in their videos, whether it was Red or whatever, you know. But I think Tawny stood out, you know, from most of those girls. She had I think she had more personality. A lot of the other girls and so on those videos were usually blondes, and you could usually picture them, you know, hanging around a rainbow or whatever. And
right.
Tawny had a different class, I think.
Agree. I totally agree. Let's get into the first Vandenberg album. You come out of the gate with Burning Heart. It goes top 40 on the Billboard Hot 100. You must have been excited. That must have been an exciting time for that song to be heading up the charts.
Yeah, that's quite an understatement, because nobody expected that, including the record company, because we didn't. It was the beginning of MTV, of course, and we didn't even have a video, because the record company was kind of assuming, okay, it's going to take some time to introduce those four spotty dust guys to radio and stuff, not even thinking about TV. But Burning Heart kind of got picked up by a couple of radio stations across the country, and it spread like crazy by itself. So the record companies appeared to be a little panicky, and they asked us, do you have a demo video so we can see what the band looks like? And so I quickly hired a local theater in my hometown in Holland, a mid-sized country town, and it had a cute little theater with a Baroque type of, you know, like the Muppet Show, the Stedler and Waldorf kind of balcony and stuff. And then we just had a couple of spotlights and a guy with a camera, and we said, well, let's make a quick demo so they can decide whether they want to record a video or something. But by the time we sent it over, Burning Heart was already becoming a hit. So they used that particular video as the band video. And that one is still on YouTube. It was like one of the cheapest videos known to mankind, I suppose, because I think it cost about $150 or something, because all I had to do was pay the theater and the camera guy, you know, and that was it.
Yeah, I watched the video last night, and it is really bare bones. And now that you give me the backstory on it, it makes sense. Wow. Yeah, because I was thinking, I'm like, boy, you would have thought they would have done a little bit more with this. But
now we
know.
And the goofy thing is, for the second album, we recorded two videos with, and it was supposed to be a proper video. So I remember the one for a song called Friday Night. And I mean, if I look at it now, it's kind of embarrassing. because there was like this story about people working in a factory, and it was like, you know, it was quite goofy. And but then when I watched it a while ago, sorry, on YouTube, on the side, you know, the sideline on YouTube where you see other bands or acts advice or something, there was right. Judas Priest with Breaking the Law. And that was at least as embarrassing as ours. So I thought, okay,
yeah,
okay, we're not alone, you know, we're not alone in our total embarrassment.
Yeah, everyone has an embarrassing video out there for sure, back in those MTV days.
Yeah.
Friday Night, it's a very poppy sounding single. I actually like your second album better than the debut. I feel like the songs are more fun or more upbeat. Was that a conscious effort, or am I just hearing that?
No, I think you're right. And writing those songs, I was, since we just did our first tour in the States, I definitely felt a different vibe in this, playing in the States than we did in Europe at the time, because the bands that came out of England, they were all dressed in jeans and a leather bomber jacket, whether it was Iron Maiden or Michael Schenker or all those British bands, they kind of looked the same. And the music was comparable to what we did on the first Vandenberg album. The second one, I wrote the songs actually in the tour bus cruising the United States from one show to another. And after we were special guests with Kiss, we started headlining again. And I just really liked the vibe of playing in the States and the more upbeat vibe in the crowd than was the case in Europe in those days. And logically, if like a band like Iron Maiden plays in a venue, if you don't have that American upbeat, slightly party-ish vibe,
right?
So I totally got influenced by that, like more upbeat vibe, and of course also I learned a little bit more about recording. The second album sounds a little bit more mature, I think.
Yeah.
But I like the first one is like a couple of young horses running and breaking out of the stables and running through the meadow and going, where the fuck are we going to go, you know? And then the second one had a little bit more direction. And I can, yeah, it's fun to listen back to it because, as you know, music is like, it takes you back to the times where you heard it for the first time. And for everybody, the music that you listen to in your life becomes the soundtrack of your life. So
sure. Yeah.
It's amazing how certain smells and certain sounds put you in a time machine and suddenly you're back there, you know, you close your eyes. And that happens very clearly with me when I listen back to those early Vandenberg albums.
The third album, Alibi, there's a song called Fighting Against the World. Was this your mindset at the time? Did you feel like Vandenberg wasn't breaking big enough? Is that what this song is about?
Thank you.
It could be, you know. Usually when I write lyrics, I go completely intuitive. I don't really think about where the ideas come from. I'm just really thankful that they keep popping into my, get picked up by my mental antenna. But I guess so, you know. Usually I realize afterwards, after I wrote some lyrics, oh, it's probably connected to this or that. The only song that I consciously wrote about someone, it's on the first Moon Kings album, the band I started after having been away for 10 years from the scene. And there's a song called Out of Reach, and that song was written about my daughter.
Nothing new to feel like I do, an emotion I can get used to. Away from home, a lonely road, and the time keeps moving on. It's burning a hole in my heart when we're apart. So out of touch, so out of reach, still in my dreams, you're here with me. A hollow feeling, a hard time dealing with the emptiness here in my.
And it was about the situation that in the first couple of years after the breakup with her mom, her mom didn't allow me to see my daughter sometimes for months in a row, and it makes you think, you know, how's she doing? I couldn't get on the phone. It was like a pretty hard time, and so I consciously wrote that song about the situation with my daughter, and that's the only song where I knew while I was writing it what it was about, what it was referring to, and all the other ones kind of happen, and then later I think, oh wait a minute, this probably has to do with this or that, you know.
Yeah. And how is the relationship with your daughter now? Is everything good?
That's great. Yeah, it's really, 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 really great. As a matter of fact, she's going to a Harry Styles concert this evening in Amsterdam, and she just sent me a video. It's total chaos. It's like 20,000 girls, and the pheromones are bursting in every direction. And she's been a Harry Styles fan, and she's 24 now. Harry Styles, when he was in One Direction, it was, of course, like a young girl band, you know, and I took her to two of those concerts at the time when my daughter was about 14 or 13. Something like that. And with a lot of those girls, you know, they keep following one of those guys, but Harry Styles is by far, of course, the most successful. And, you know, he's a little bit like a young Mick Jagger, but more of these days. And now she's doing really great. And I'm just thankful, you know, that everything has smoothed out. Unfortunately, she doesn't really remember that period of those years where I didn't get to see her barely.
That's good. That's good that she doesn't remember that. She remembers the times now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a great thing.
So, Adrian, being in the music business, are you able to help out in getting good seats for a Harry Styles concert?
Well, I used to. I always feel a little embarrassed, you know, doing that. I would have done so, but sometimes I go, oh man, you know, it's a little embarrassing if I ask the promoter, do you have a couple of good seats? You know, when my daughter was a lot younger, I took her to a Lady Gaga show, and she was a fan, and we got really good seats. And after I did it a couple of times, I thought, man, I don't feel right with kind of begging for free tickets or like even doing it. I'd rather buy myself, you know, for them. Yeah.
That says a lot about you. You seem like a really down to earth, just solid. I don't like to use the word normal, but you know what I mean? You just seem like a solid guy.
Yeah, I am. You know, I'm just a happy guy. And the days of the day go by that I'm really thankful and grateful about the fact that I'm still chasing my dreams and my passions and be able to make some kind of a living of my passions. And both my parents were very, they really raised us that way, you know. Don't, you know, just be yourself. Don't try to hold up something, or don't get on a high horse and all that stuff. You know, whenever somebody was doing that, my mom used to say, look at that person. Why does he or she do that? You know, we're all on this planet and we're all trying to make the best of it. And that definitely formed my sister, brother, and me. We are. My sister's a classical piano player. She's amazing. And she's like that too. My brother works for the United Nations and he's all over the world and stuff. We're totally different, all three of us. But that's how we were raised, and we regularly talk about it. My mom passed away at 96 years old a year ago. And we, ever since she passed away, we seem to talk more about how lucky we were to get raised in a warm nest like our parents provided for us. It really forms you, like everybody knows, you know, if you grow up in a difficult family where the parents don't really get along, you get used to the kind of tension, and you very often see that somebody creates a life like that because as well later when they're grown up. And very often when they're young, they think, oh, I'm never ever going to do that. And they still end up doing it, you know. It's so important how you get raised, and in what kind of nest you have the privilege to grow up, or the bad luck to grow up, or whatever, you know.
So obviously raised with good values, and when you and your brother and sister talk about your mom, you keep her memory alive. So I'm sorry about her passing, but that's nice.
I got memories. A ring. This is the ring of my mother. I carry it with me on my one of my chains. Yeah, she was a very, very special woman, and I think most people think that about their mom. I had a very special connection with my mom, which is why my sister and brother said, you know, you take that ring, because they were fully aware of the connection that my mom and I had. And 96 is a beautiful age, of course, and she was. And we were very lucky that she didn't have a long suffering end of her life. She, basically, one morning she just didn't wake up, and that was it, you know. So we're thankful that that's the way it went.
It's hard to pivot now back into music, Adrian, but we're gonna do it, we'll do it as awkwardly as possible.
It's fine. It's fine.
Adrian, Vandenberg's Moon Kings, how does that differ from Vandenberg? Why didn't you just call that band Vandenberg?
Well, initially, I started Moon Kings about 8 years ago or something. It was there was no interest in rock whatsoever. Fortunately, it has came a bit more to life in the last couple of years again. But at the time, I stayed out of the music scene for about 10, 11 years to watch my daughter grow up. What I talked about before, when I didn't really get to see her as often as I would have loved to, when the relationship fell apart, I thought, if I'm going to start a band again right now, I will be one of those dads who sticks his head around the corner two or three times a year. I say, hi, I'm your dad, but I have to go, sorry, you know. So I thought, you know, I'm going to stay away until I will be able to explain to her what I do. So when I started Moon Kings, I decided to go back to my very early roots and make it a blues rock band. Not too heavy, but definitely very much based on the kind of blues rock that my very first band in 1977, a band called Teaser. We only made one album, but it was very much based on the band Free and Bad Company. Those were big influences on me. The singer even looked like Paul Rodgers, you know, and he sounded like him. So I went back to basically build it up again. And since the music was slightly, well, quite different than what I used to do with Vandenberg, I thought it would be kind of weird to call it Vandenberg because stylistically it's quite different. I've always been zigzagging between blues rock and between more melodic hard rock, like in Vandenberg. So when a couple of years ago, when I had to stop with Moonkings because my good friend, the singer Jan, is a great singer, but he has a huge farming company and he could never be away longer than a couple of days from his farm because then he got all nervous and stuff. So we couldn't really tour internationally. And I really started missing that. I really wanted to do international shows again. And we did a tour with Scorpions in France and it was 6 days. And that was the first time ever since he was 18 years old that he was longer outside of the country than just 1 or 2 days. So I thought, you know, if I'm not going to keep calling it Moon Kings because stylistically I went back to the more heavier rock that I'm still playing now. But I always had a plan, you know, at some point I would like to make another Moon Kings record and do a Dutch tour with those guys again because we had so much fun on stage. It was such a special chemistry that we had on stage that everybody had a great time, the band and the people. And who knows, you know, at some point, like next year or the year after, make another Moon Kings album and do a Dutch tour. I'll keep you posted.
So the difference in names, are just so the Vandenberg purists know that that's something different. Don't expect Vandenberg when you hear Moon Kings. All right, let's talk a little bit more about Sin. The album kicks off with Thunder and Lightning. Such a great song. How hard is it to choose the song that's going to start the album? Because that really sets the tone for what we're going to hear.
Yeah, and I remember coming up with the music for the song and with the way the accents were started with. Ta-da-na, ta-da-na. I thought, oh man, that's going to be a great opener for a show. And then later on, I thought, that's going to be a great opener for an album too, because you don't know what's going to happen. It starts like a thunderbolt. It goes, ta-da-da-da-da-da. You go, what? And then at a different moment than you would expect, because it the counting is different, you get another hit of a bolt of lightning, and then bam, you know, it starts rolling. So, yeah, it was, for me, it was quite easy to decide to start with a song. Although Mats actually later on, he said he would have preferred to start with the other up-tempo song, which is, let's see, it gets a little lighting, and the other one, the other up-tempo one, somewhere on the album. I haven't heard the songs in quite a while.
Is it Hit the Ground Running?
Yeah, Hit the Ground Running. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Mats said, that would have been a great opener too, but I chose actually for this one because of those accents that I start with, because it's out of the blue, bam, you know, could be pretty cool.
Well, I also made a notation on the song Hit the Ground Running because the title is perfect because that song literally hits the ground running.
So it goes right away, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there's another one, you know, like I said before, I usually when I work on a music, a title kind of gets picked up and a couple of vocal lines. So from all the choruses, that's how it started. And I send the title or tell Mats the title and I hum the melody of the opening of the chorus. And he now usually takes it up from there and then we start ping-ponging back and forth ideas. And when it takes shape, and it's every time is just as excited as writing my very first song. Every time when it takes shape, I go, oh man, this is going to be good. I can't wait to play it live, you know?
Well, for me, this is one of the best Vandenberg albums. This is a really great album. You have to be proud of the work you've done on this one. It's, when I dropped the digital needle, I was just so excited because it sounds so good.
Thank you very much, man. I you're right. I'm really proud of it because every time I remember starting to write for this one and I thought, man, it's going to be pretty hard to top 2020 because I was very happy with that one too. And I always try to raise the bar a little bit more, you know, and I got intimidated by the stuff I did in the past. I go, oh man, I can't afford to make it less good than the ones I've done, you know, and then suddenly the ideas start rolling in. I go, oh, wait a minute, you know, this could be a good album again. So, yeah, I'm just thankful, you know, this stuff happens. And I know Keith Richard once described it as you put out your antenna, which I mentioned a couple of times in this conversation. You put out some kind of an antenna and you hope that you pick up something. And with me, as soon as I got a guitar on my lap, always something happens. And I recorded into my iPhone. I must have about 3,000 ideas at least on my iPhone. So whenever I start the writing process, I go through and I go, oh, this is cool. Yeah, that's cool. Oh, that sucks. And then I erase it right away.
Right.
I don't want to waste my time listening to it again, you know. But yeah, I'm just a blessed guy, you know. I really feel that way.
And you said that you were gone for 10 years to raise your daughter and be around as a dad. Obviously, some rock stars aren't good with their money, but obviously you must be if you were able to take that chunk of time off. You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but in those days, I was selling my paintings.
Ah, okay.
So that's one lucky thing that I've got a backup. And also, the other thing is I don't have a high level of living, you know. I basically still feel like a vintage student because the things that I love doing and the things that make me feel really good are not expensive things. My car has got 400,000 kilometers on it, and I'm still happy with it. It's like it looks like a Batmobile, you know. It's like this big Chrysler 300C. touring thing.
Yeah.
400,000 kilometers, which is in miles. Let's see. I think 55 miles is 100 kilometers, I think. So, well, you can do the math, you know. It's a lot. And so I don't really care, you know. I've got my guitar. I'm just a happy guy and I like a good glass of wine, you know. Sometimes I don't drink for a week, but when I do drink wine, I drink a good one. And that's one of my very few things that make me feel, give me a luxurious feeling. It doesn't matter, you know, because I have a couple of friends who are pretty well off. And I don't have the impression that they're happier than me, you know. it's just as a human being, you get used to everything. I can see the people who are very wealthy, very quickly they get used to their new Porsche or their new Ferrari or whatever. And then after a couple of months, they go, okay, yeah, maybe next year I'm going to get another car. So you get used to everything. And then you try to raise the bar the next time. And before you know it, you know, your lifestyle costs you like $300,000 a year or something. I don't care, you know. My riches are my friends and my family and my guitars and the stuff that's happening in my head. That's what makes me feel a wealthy person because I always have ideas for everything and anything. And a good sense of humor is very important too.
Well, Adrian, I mean, all these things you're saying are things that everyone should take to heart, because I feel like you're such a grounded person. And I think that the goodness inside comes out just in your physical appearance. How old are you going to be this year?
I'm 69 now.
You look incredible.
Thank you, man. Thanks. I don't know what's going on with me. Sometimes I think I'm some kind of a scientific experiment or something. Because I don't even believe in myself, you know. I must say, my mom, I suppose I got very blessed with strong genes. My mom, when she was 95, when she got to be 95, I asked her, Mom, she was dementing a little bit, you know. She was slowly sinking a little bit away in dementia. And I said, Mom, how old do you think you are right now today? And she said, well, let me think about it. I suppose I must be about 70, 72. And she was 95.
Yeah.
Now she, and I think I inherited from her that I totally ignore the whole thing. You know, I still have the same life as when I was 20. I do the same things. And I do take care of my health in the sense of I love cooking, you know, so I always make sure that I cook healthily. And I get some exercise, not ridiculous, you know, sometimes a couple of weeks, nothing. And then I go rollerblading for a couple of weeks until I've had enough of that. And then I get on my bicycle. It's nothing special or something, yeah. But I suppose my joy for life has a lot to do with it, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I can recommend everybody, you know, count your blessings and take a little bit of care of your health and take care of the loved ones around you. And as we all know, the world is a total chaos right now. I think in a couple of years, we're going to look back on this time frame. We go, oh, shit, what was going on back then, you know?
Yeah.
Like a war here and a war there and natural disasters and God knows what, you know? I mean, if you take it to heart and with all the input you get these days from through the internet, I can understand why some people get really confused and bewildered and go, man, what's all this stuff about? Because if you think back 50 years ago or something, when there wasn't all this input that there is these days,
yeah,
you read a newspaper and the headline goes, well, there's some shit going on in Saudi Arabia or whatever. You go, oh, that's bad, you know, that's not good. And then that's it. But right now, you got images of people who are getting bombarded and there's hunger here and there's natural disasters there. I mean, I actually, I'm very interested in politics, but I must say, a couple of weeks ago, I decided, you know, I'm just going to read a couple of headlines every other day, because I started feeling that it was getting to me, you know, all the chaos in the world and then all the stuff, you know, and I feel much better since I read it a couple of times a week. I go, okay, that's not good and that's good. Let's get on with life, because otherwise, you know, you get sucked into it and you're going to have all these negative emotions inside you, and it's never good.
Yeah, it's much easier to stay positive around yourself and your friends and your family if you're not bombarded and taking all that negativity in 24/7.
Yeah.
I can't think of a better way to end than on this talk of positivity. So I just want to let people know one more time, August 25th, Sin will be out. It's the fifth album by the band Vandenberg. CD, digital, limited edition green vinyl. You can go to vandenbergband.com. You can go to @VandenbergBand on Twitter and Instagram to find everything you need to know about Adrian Vandenberg, the new album, and the band Vandenberg. One more question, Adrian. It might be a tough one. We need a playout song for the episode. It can be any song. It can be any song from your entire career. It can be a song from the new album. What do you pick?
I would pick the title song Sin, because when I finished that one, I thought this is probably the most epic song that I ever put together. So I'm really, really proud of it. Much of singing his ass off. The Coon and Randy are as solid as a rock, and I'm kind of trying to keep up with them with my guitar fumbling. So
I think you're keeping up just fine, Adrian. Thank you so much for doing this today. All my listeners, go buy this album, and everyone, please enjoy the song Sin. Have a great day, Adrian.
Thanks, you too. Thanks very much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
I've done left behind. Wherever I'm going, wherever I've been, there will always be. Dude!